from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They call him the Hammer on Capitol Hill because he hits hard, maybe harder than anyone. But lately, House Majority Leader Tom DeLay has been taking some hits of his own. He's been the subject of a string of reprimands and ethics investigations. Now, opponents and even some conservative watchdog groups like Judicial Watch are calling for his resignation. The story of how Tom DeLay took control of the House of Representatives and how he uses that power is the story of Washington's conversion from bare-knuckles to brass-knuckles politics. Tonight on Point, power, ethics, and the way of House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. Do you know how Tom DeLay has reshaped American politics? Have you heard the noise that's coming out of the House Ethics Committee and the Travis County Prosecutor's Office in Texas? Is Tom DeLay a threat or a godsend? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight are the co-authors of the new book, The Hammer, Tom DeLay, God, Money, and the Rise of the Republican Congress, from Austin, Texas. Jan Reed, award-winning novelist and senior writer for Texas Monthly. Jan Reed, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And from Lafayette, Louisiana, Lou DuBose, who co-authored Bushwhacked and Shrub with Molly Ivins and is former editor at the Texas Observer. Lou DuBose, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
So here you are, both of you, at a particularly interesting moment, putting the shovel in on Tom DeLay. We'll come to everything that we've heard in just the last week or two out of Texas and out of Washington, but we really want to get a sense of where this man came from, since the kind of overwhelming influence that he became today, before he hit that influence in Washington. Lou, jump in with us here. Take us back to the origins of Tom DeLay. Who is this man who now wields so much power on Capitol Hill?
You know, it's a bit of a Mr. Smith goes to Washington story. And I think it ends up whether it's Mr. Smith goes to the pinnacle of leadership or Mr. Smith goes to jail, although that latter may be overstated. Tom DeLay was a pesticide, an exterminator in Sugarland, Texas, which is now a suburb of Houston. Mm. What drove Mr. Smith to Washington was Myrex, a pesticide that killed fire ants and was banned by the EPA. He belonged to a little Republican sort of a handicapping club, picking races and trying to teach people to run for races. And when his moment came, Myrex was banned. He ran against Myrex. He ran against regulation. And he ran and won a seat in the Republican House, State House in Texas, where he was fairly inconsequential, except for his persistent fight on behalf of deregulation of everything. He believes that nothing, government has no role in regulating public health, public safety, and such things as that. So he was known as Tom DeReg, for those speeches, and for his social life he was known as Hot Tub Tom.
And there he was, sitting in Texas. Nobody had any idea that he would become such a major, major player in Washington. Jan Reed, you point out that, like President Bush, Tom DeLay had a conversion experience, a come-to-Jesus experience that changed his life, as the public knows it.
It was, in many ways, completely different from Mr. Bush, in that Mr. Bush was counseled by his father's great friend, Billy Graham. Mr. DeLay, on the other hand, was just into his first term. And as he bragged, boasted of his capacity, was knocking down 12 or 13 martinis a night, and was guilt-ridden and living a very stressful life. And a colleague gave him a videotape, and it was a sermon by the Reverend James Dobson about, where's Daddy, regaining your life in the family. And as he said, it brought him to his knees, and it was his moment on the road to Damascus. And Mr. DeLay had a background in small town Texas as Southern Baptist, but had strayed far from that time. But he came back to, and when he found the faith, he found it at a time when it, I have no doubt that his faith is genuine, but it also happened that it was just the time when the Christian right was becoming a huge force in American politics, and he connected with them and has harnessed that base very well. And he's since that moment become an immensely more effective politician.
In your book, The Hammer, you write about how Tom DeLay put together his support from the Christian right and corporate millions to become an incredible powerhouse. We'll look at the how of that in some detail tonight. But Lou DeBose, I wish you'd just describe for us why Tom DeLay has earned the nickname The Hammer and exactly what it is that he brings to Capitol Hill, even as we sit here tonight, even with the ethics allegations that have been swirling around him more recently, or more acutely recently. What is it about Tom DeLay that makes him so feared on Capitol Hill?
He is not afraid to use the political power and the political base that he has built since 1995 when he was elected whip. You know, he methodically ran for a position of power while no one really paid attention. He's a man that has been a master of staying under the radar. He was not a part of Newt's revolution, Gingrich's revolution, yet he now owns it. He runs it. He's the only survivor because he insinuated himself into it by running in 1995 against Newt's chosen candidate for whip when Newt was elected speaker. And, you know, this was the time, this was the Republican wave, the Congress of 94 that has reshaped the modern Congress. And DeLay wasn't supposed to be a leader in it. However, while he had been out working, raising money, and it's all about money, he raised $780,000, spent it very wisely on picking and handicapping Republican races, so that and set up a leadership school, you know, sent out brochures, taught candidates how to place signs in yards. Went and did fundraisers, traveled to 28 states, and cultivated a base with which he began in 1995 by spending $750,000 of his PAC money. But he also spent $2 million, he's since said this, he said he lost count at $2 million, of lobby money. And that lobby money was also funneled to these Republican candidates. So when it comes time to run for whip, Bob Walker, you know, an old-time congressman who was part of Newt's revolution, he'd spent $1,000 on other races, and DeLay had spent almost $3 million. So it begins with money and loyalty that's built of money. He builds a whip organization unlike the modern Congress or probably any Congress has ever seen. 66 deputy whips, one of whom was Denny Hastert, who ran his whip campaign and whom he later appointed appointed to be speaker. So he built this whip organization of 66 deputy whips. He twisted arms. He saw that votes were counted. One congressman said there were two of them for each of us, watching each one of us. And he also saw to every need that his loyal followers had. Green fees, he would arrange them for you. Restaurant reservations, you could call Tom DeLay's office. Speakers needed in your district, call the whip. So it started with loyalty, but then came enormous pressure. He is not above, and he has done this. If a Republican, one of his own party members in the Republican caucus, disagrees with him, he'll go out and recruit he will tell them first to get in line, and then he'll go out and recruit a primary candidate. He has sat in auditions for committee chairs with a book of who gives what money, and who gives what money is who gets what position. So it's almost every lever, and also he is a man who can be, despite the fact that he's 5'7" and portly, he can be intimidating. He is physically intimidating and sort of psychologically intimidating. So he's the whole package in that sense.
Lou, all of this sounds in many dimensions like just a very effective politician, and yet Tom DeLay excites the most kind of extravagant hopes from his supporters and the most dark fears from his detractors, so that we understand why feelings run so high about this man. We should lay out in the starkest terms this kind of polarity, those extravagant hopes of his supporters, those dark, dark fears of his detractors. Paint those two pictures for us.
Well, his detractors, I think his defenders have a very good reason to defend him. And what they want is, and Tom DeLay has now written it, and he's said it for years, a few years, and he's written it, What he wants is a permanent Republican majority, and he talks about the permanent Republican majority. He says and has said that Democrats in the House are irrelevant, and they are rendered irrelevant by him. It's essentially a parliamentary system that he runs in which party votes, you must vote for the party or the government fails. So he's basically the prime minister of the United States House.
And a permanent Republican majority to do what in the wishes of his hardcore supporters, in the dream?
Not quite to govern, but to rule, to eliminate all worker protections, to eliminate, you know, there were 17 riders, 15 to 17 budget riders, the number slips my mind, in 95 that he wrote, that would have dismantled the EPA. Carol Branner told me that she looked at them and there was nothing in the contract for America about the EPA, Newt's contract, and she looked at it and said, this is all about us. He set out to dismantle the EPA. Look at worker protections. This is what they want, and this is what they don't want. The one side wants, and the other doesn't. Mm-hmm. For 12 years, we had been in a process that was started by Elizabeth Dole when she was Secretary of Labor, of passing labor standards to protect people from injured backs, from repetitive motions, carpal tunnel syndrome, from working in freezing factories. You know, just basic standards. Everybody had weighed in on this. I've got a ton of hearing papers on my desk, I think. You know, thousands of hours of testimony. They got it put on the books. Clinton put it on the books at the very end on the Federal Register, at the end of his term. Delay comes in. Bush is elected, and he finds a way to bust it. And he eliminates 12 years of hearings and process with something called the Congressional Reauthorization Act, which allows only 10 hours of debate in each chamber, has the rare exception of cutting off debate in the Senate, no filibuster. So in 20 hours and two votes, they killed this bill that had been, not a bill, a set of rules that had been in the works for 12 years to protect workers, the most basic protections. So, you know, the business community wants this. The labor and working folks don't. If you want an EPA, if you want environmental protections, he's called it the Gestapo government. His assaults on Carol Browner in Texas, he might have been put in jail for them, what he did in a House committee when he would go after Carol Browner while she was Clinton's EPA director. So, you know, they are very stark. If you want government, and if you want campaign finance reform, if you want some caps on what can be spent, then you are an opponent of Tom DeLay. His campaign finance belief is very simple: contribute as much as possible, and disclose it. So you can, you know, it's the Texas system metastasized.
And Jan Reed, it's also a process fear that I read in the pages of your book. Opponents feeling like the government, like the politics of the United States, are being fundamentally changed by this man.
Well, yes, in that Mr. DeLay came from a long, long way back. He was he did not come in with a star's resume, and he has mastered process both in the particularly in the money of politics, but also the procedures in the House. And as he has gained loyalty and gained power, and as the Republicans have now gained a pretty secure majority, they have set limited rules of debate to the point that they almost don't exist. There is no debate, and it is they bringing his colleagues around to a particular point of view that among other, he goes after moderate Republicans. Is to the Democrats are really as Luther was saying, they're irrelevant and have no role in the debate, but process is being shaped in the House by the Republican majority, very conservative majority,
and Tom DeLay right at the
lobby.
And the lobbyists will look at all of that. We've got to take a short break right here. Jan Reed, Lou DeBose, authors of The Hammer, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the life and times of House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, the Texas congressman who is remaking American politics and pushing every boundary in the book while he does it. You can join the conversation tonight. Have you looked into the noises coming out of the House Ethics Committee and the Travis County prosecutor in Texas? Do you know how Tom DeLay is reshaping American politics? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. My guests are Lou DeBose and Jan Reed. They are co-authors of the new book, The Hammer, Tom DeLay, God, Money, and the Rise of the Republican Congress. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you see an unholy alliance of God and money behind Tom DeLay? Or is this just good GOP politics? Can you imagine an entire Congress paralyzed by fear of one man, The Hammer? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Lou DeBose, there's a lot more we want to hear about the closet of Tom DeLay tonight, but he's in a world of trouble right now, and I wish you'd describe that to us and give us your assessment of just how serious it is. Does it mean he'll never be Speaker of the House? Is his career in trouble, or is he still going to turn a corner here? What's going on?
Can we continue for another hour and a half? Well, there's a lot. I mean, the guy is in real trouble. He has achieved what he has achieved by really pushing the envelope on fundraising, by pushing the envelope on domesticating the lobby, by pushing the envelope on forcing his own members to behave in a certain way. But where he really is in trouble now is in Texas, it's almost impossible to violate a campaign finance law in Texas. There's one thing you can't do. You can't raise and spend corporate money on an election. Now, I can say without the standard journalism, CYA allegedly, they spent corporate money and they spent a lot of it. And what happened is, in Texas in particular.
And this is around the indictment out of Travis County, around Austin.
These are the indictments of the leader himself, mm-hmm. but three of his fundraisers that he put in place, and a PAC for a political action committee he set up, and eight corporations. And what happened was over the years the Texas Republicans were gaining on the Democrats, and they had pretty much eliminated everything except the state house, which was controlled by Democrats. They pushed very hard to do it by 2000, so that by 2001 they could redraw the state's congressional lines to create more. Democrat Republican favored districts in the state. When they couldn't do it, they decided to come back and plan a late redistricting session after, it's traditionally done the year after the census. Mm-hmm. It's almost extra constitutional. But they did. In order to do that, they had to win. To win, they raised $1.5 million. Half of that money was corporate. It's illegal to spend corporate money on an election in Texas. Has been since 1905. They know that. We all know it. They didn't even book that money in on the books with the Texas Election Commission. They booked it in with the IRS in Washington, and a watchdog group called Citizens for Public Justice caught them, turned it over to the DA, and he started investigating. The investigation lasted for about a year and a half, and it's timely as now. It's not timed because of politics. It's timed because of the election. It is they indicted now because they stonewalled for a year and a half and challenged every request for documents, every document demanded discovery. Now stand indicted in Texas.
So does that mean that Tom DeLay is in the gun sights of the law in Texas? Are they coming after him? Do they have the goods, the nerve?
You know, if they don't have the goods, we have the goods. And I don't want to sound like a boastful journalist. I mean, not we. The boss, the Washington Post has the goods. You know, we turned up in civil litigation a letter that's from a corporate officer from the Williams Corporation. This corporation is now indicted in Texas, that says, "Dear Congressman DeLay, enclosed is the $25,000 promised for the Trim Pack." Now, that was his Texas pack at a specific June fundraiser. Mm. Best wishes. Well, he's going to need it. That's one. You know, at about the same time we found this, the Washington Post turned up memos in which Congressman DeLay himself was leaning on two Enron lobbyists to get $100,000, to obtain $100,000 in contributions for some corporate and some individual, and the corporate is illegal. What they didn't count on was an independent district attorney in Travis County who has statewide prosecutorial authority, mm-hmm. and they thought they could roll over him. They didn't. He indicted 8 corporations and 3 of DeLay's fundraisers from his PAC, and those people are going to be sitting on a stand, on a witness stand in Texas, corporate officials and all, under oath, thinking about, you know, playing jail with Congressman Jimmy Trafficant, who's locked up for, you know, bad hair and bribery.
And now we've got this Travis County prosecutor, Ronnie Earle. Tom DeLay calls him a runaway district attorney with a long history of being vindictive and partisan. Mr. Earle replies, being called vindictive and partisan by Tom DeLay is like being called ugly by a frog. Jan Reed, are Republicans getting nervous about Tom DeLay these days? I'm reading here the Denver Post, fairly conservative editorial page, says Tom DeLay apparently can't smell the coffee when the pot's perking away. Judicial Watch, conservative watchdog group, saying it's time for him to retire to private life. What's the sentiment in the Republican camp?
Well, he certainly has his ardent defenders, and there's some angry rhetoric coming out in his defense. Something that I saw that really kind of startled me last week was David Brooks, the columnist for the New York Times, tends to favor Republicans and Republican mm-hmm. positions. He was saying, well, you know, he's not going to be. He may not. He didn't believe that he'd be forced to resign, but this meant that he wasn't going to be speaker, and that this happens when you dance too close to the edge, and he's done it for a long time. And he described it as, you know, a naked kind of politics. I was surprised to hear that from him. But he's. Significant that this ethics committee, which had been completely inert by both parties had set this up for 7 years, but now suddenly they have come out with admonishments, reprimands of Mr. DeLay is seen in Washington is really quite significant.
So the seams may be opening up a little bit here. We've got a lot more to hear, but I want to bring our callers in. We're at 1-800-423-8255, talking about House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, the Hammer. Josh is calling from Newbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Josh. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling. The other day I saw a clip from C-SPAN with Tom DeLay speaking for the anti-gay amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't believe how successful this man is. It just seemed like he was very incoherent. You know, the first thing he said was, this amendment has nothing to do with marriage and has nothing to do with homosexuality, which, of course, is exactly what it's about. Mm-hmm. And then he went on this long rant that didn't seem to make any sense at all. I mean, it seems like, if he's for deregulation, he seems to be for deregulation of everything except for marriage.
So what were you struck by there, Josh? You're saying that he's hypocritical around the deregulation view, or you don't understand why he became such a power with that demeanor?
Exactly. In terms of how he could have so much power being with his demeanor, and it just didn't seem like he seemed very incoherent. It didn't seem like his arguments made much sense, and I was just amazed that this man was so successful.
Josh, we've got it. Let us pick it up. Lou DeBose, take us inside Tom DeLay a little bit. You write in the book, son of an alcoholic father who belt-whipped his children, deserted by the mother. What makes Tom DeLay tick?
He's... he's a son of a dysfunctional family, and I guess in a sense all families are dysfunctional, but his was really dysfunctional. But what makes him tick, I think, is this intense desire to overcome all that. I mean, he abandoned his mother. It was in reverse, actually. He left his mother. He won't speak to his mother. She lives 12 miles from his house, 10 miles from his house in Sugar Land. He has nothing to do with her. She watches him on C-SPAN. He cut his brother loose because his brother was lobbying. The other brother has a sad history of alcoholism in and out of jail. He doesn't have anything to do with his sister. The Congress is his family, and it's remaking this family and making it into a family that works. I don't think, you know, he's not a Ciceronian speaker, but I wouldn't, you know, there's a mistake made about underestimating the political skills of someone because they talk bad, because he does. He's not articulate, mm-hmm. Eloquent. Mm-hmm. He doesn't fill the room when he walks in like Bill Clinton does, but he is more than any other politician I've ever seen in control all the time. He's all about control, and maybe it's because the family was out, like, I don't want to put the guy on the couch, but maybe it's because the control was lacking. But he is an incredibly dominant force. He's remarkably vindictive. There was a case in Texas. He was sued by a business partner, and it was a typical, you know, small time business fight over the spoils of a failing business, mm-hmm. Albo mm-hmm. Pest Control. Well, he got crossways with his business partner, Bill Blank. I don't remember the first name, Blankenship. Jan probably does, but he told his wife, and then he then put out the word in Fort Bend County that where he lived that Jacqueline Blankenship could be hired in no other Republican office. Now, here was a woman who'd stuffed envelopes, walked blocks, manned phone banks, run campaigns, worked on President Bush's first campaign, and Tom DeLay didn't want her to get a job because he was angry with her husband. Well, that's okay. You put the word out. Mm. The sheriff hires her. A former Texas Ranger, Milton Wright, hires Jacqueline Blankenship in defiance of Tom DeLay. Now, here you have a leader from Congress, comes back to Texas, spends $70,000 on a primary in a sheriff's race. A local sheriff's race, and tries to put the sheriff out of business. And he failed. And Sheriff Wright, in his parting words to Tom DeLay, was, "Tom DeLay, a little man, 5'7", if he's wearing high heels, he can kiss my ass." But not many people say that to Tom DeLay, because at 5'7", he has a lot of physical and psychological stature.
Let's get another call here. Robert's calling from Elizabeth City, North Carolina. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hello. I've been enjoying the show.
Good. Good to have you.
I just wanted to say that Tom DeLay is just a pimple on the pretty face of the Republican movement to create a one-party system in this country. And I think he and the other Texas posse have take their inspiration from Mexico, watching the PRD run that country for 50 years.
You think he can succeed, Robert?
It doesn't matter. If Tom DeLay ends up, you know, being forced out of the office, it doesn't really matter. Someone else will step in and continue the mission. He'll work behind the scenes if he has to. But this is the drive by the Republican Party to create a one-party system.
The one-party system. Robert, thanks for your call. Jan Reed, here's the idea. You've both raised it. A one-party system, is that literally what Tom DeLay would like to see? Does he think that's would be good for the country?
Yes. In the sense that the caller's comparison to the PRI in Mexico is really very apt, in that there have been opposition parties in were opposition parties for those 70 years in Mexico, but they were marginalized. They were forced into very small issues, and every election it came around went to this one party, and that's certainly their ambition, and they think it that in their dreams at night, they think that they're in range of that. And it's not just Mr. DeLay; it's Karl Rove, it's Grover Norquist, who's a theorist and intellectual in Washington of that view, who said that his dream is to make sure that no one grows up thinking it's acceptable to be a member of the Democratic Party. You know, they can be the tree hugger party, they can be the any secular party, but it's that kind of really contempt and for not just for the opponent, but for the process, and certainly for any kind of attempt at consensus.
And Lou DeBose, speak to us about the alliances that have made that dream appear possible. I guess most of all in Tom DeLay's case, about his backing by the evangelical Christian community, and then I want to turn to lobbyists. But first, that Christian right, how has he embraced it? How has it embraced him?
Well, he's their man. He's George Bush's go-to guy for the Christian right. And I attended his church for a couple of times just to see what it was about. It's a standard sort of Baptist church, Texas Baptist church. No, good-looking young preacher, charismatic guy, but a very fundamental, worship band instead of a mighty fortress is my God hymns. Mm-hmm. But I think that's Lutheran. But basically it's a fundamentalist message. That we see embraced by the Republican Party, and he talks to it probably better than any other member of the Republican Party because he actually walks it. Extremely conservative, anti-gay, as your one caller pointed out, anti-gay rights, absolutely opposed to abortion, and these are the issues that, in Texas we say we run gun gods and gays campaign, and you win in East Texas. You're for. Mm-hmm. You're for one, and you're for God and guns, and you're against gays. Mm-hmm. But he's their man. He's their go-to person. I think that of a greater concern is when this becomes foreign policy. Tom DeLay also spends some time with pre-dispensational millennialists. That's a mouthful, but
translate that for us.
It's a religious it's a religious belief based on an interpretation of the Old Testament, and that religious belief that certain things have to certain prophecies have to occur in the Middle East in particular for the second coming of Christ to occur. So the things that have to happen that can be affected by public policy are things that ought to concern us, and they're things that they actually believe they want to make happen,
such as
uniting all of Israel, biblical Israel, such as rebuilding the temple of the Mount. And when you do that, then you can have getting rid of the most sacred mosque in all of Islam, destroying that to rebuild the Jewish temple.
And all this is to take place so that what can unfold?
So that Armageddon can happen. So you have to have this war. Then when Armageddon happens, the Antichrist will fight Christ. Christ will return. We'll have 1,000 years of peace. It just doesn't sound like something on which to base a sound foreign policy. Yet they believe it. And Tom DeLay is trying to implement that foreign policy. He busted the president's roadmap to peace by traveling to Israel on the day that Sharon was flying here to advance it. He criticized it publicly in Israel. Here's a religious belief that holds it. At the end, when all this is concluded, only 144,000 Jews will be left to live. And it is the basis for a certain sect of Christianity's foreign policy. And he shows up at these temples, at these congregations, and speaks to them.
And this is driving U.S.
business.
Foreign policy on Israel today?
In part it is. When Tom DeLay goes to John Hagee's Cornerstone Temple and Church in San Antonio and stands up beside Reverend Hagee and endorses this, and Reverend Hagee says that we must have a regathering of the Jews, we have to have Armageddon in order for Christ to return, we ought to all take notice.
This, the House Majority Leader in the U.S. Congress. I'm joined tonight by Lou DeBose and Jan Reed. Their new book is The Hammer, Tom DeLay, God, Money, and the Rise of the Republican Congress. You can join our conversation tonight. What does the Tom DeLay world look like to you? Are we fully in it? Is there more to come? Does the Tom DeLay story explain American politics today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the life and times of House Majority Leader Tom DeLay of Sugar Land, Texas. My guests tonight, Lou DeBose and Jan Reed, they are co-authors of the new book, The Hammer, Tom DeLay, God, Money, and the Rise of the Republican Congress. You can join our conversation tonight. What do you hear in the story of Tom DeLay? Have you been aware of just how great and direct corporate influence has become in the years of Tom DeLay in Washington? And who is keeping this House Majority Leader accountable? Is anyone? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Amy is calling from Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. Hi, Amy. You're on the air.
Hi.
Good evening.
Good evening. Hi. I just wanted to make the comment that I guess I always bristle a little bit whenever I hear someone attacking someone's religious beliefs, whether it be Christianity, whether it be Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
To go after someone and criticize them and believe that they are incapable of separating their personal religious beliefs from their job, I think is ludicrous. I think that we've had many countless examples of politicians with various beliefs who have done a fine job of separating those two. And I think anybody in public office has historically that separation between church and state and the necessity of certain personal beliefs, how you just, you know, you keep that in your heart, but you still have to follow the laws of your land and uphold those laws. And I don't see that Tom DeLay is any different in that. And I think it's a smokescreen to try to just argue a certain opposing agenda to his. But I really don't believe that when it comes to a personal religious conviction that we should be criticizing someone like that.
Amy, you've got it. And it's an interesting point, especially with a politician who isn't shy about kind of working both sides of that street at the same time. But you're saying there's still a way to keep a line here and grant Tom DeLay the benefit of the doubt there. Let us pick that up. Lou DeBose, Amy's saying, come on, this is just Democrats with their own agenda. They don't like Tom DeLay's, but, you know, Americans can have deep religious beliefs and still be active in politics and have a decent respect for a separation of the two. Is that a fair description of Tom DeLay's work?
I agree with Amy in that politics and religion can be kept separate. Tom DeLay has not done so, though, and he's openly said so. He talks about a biblical worldview for this country. Now, we are by majority a Christian nation, but we're not by government nor by constitution a Christian nation. There's a fine distinction, I think, and I think that Amy raises a really good point. But you know, I've talked to Rabbi David Saperstein, who is very concerned about a Jew who is very concerned about Tom DeLay's courting of Jews and about this whole premillennial dispensationalist argument that as it plays itself out in Israel. So I think that yes, that's right, but I don't think it's right in the case of Tom DeLay because he has been so aggressively proposing that we impose a biblical worldview on this country.
Let's get another caller in from Mark in McHenry, Illinois. Mark, you're on the air.
Good evening. You know, I generally have been a conservative voter on issues such as the Second Amendment, et cetera. However,
yeah.
I also feel a strong commitment toward a separation of church and state, and the kind of millennialist wingnut goofiness that I'm hearing attributed to this guy. If in fact this is true, then this is enough to get me to start to look at the other side, because I don't want this kind of epistemology driving our foreign policy. It you know, and again, I'm generally a conservative voter, but this distresses me, and I'm going to look into this further.
Mark, have you been paying attention inside Republican politics? Do you feel a tension inside the Republican Party between the kind of evangelical wing that Tom DeLay so often speaks for and more traditional Republicans?
I don't know, because I'm not actually a member of the Republican Party. I sense that there is that sort of tension building, just as there are tensions building on in the Democratic Party between mm-hmm. the more moderate and farther more liberal wings. I don't know where that'll take us, but I think it's time for a lot of people to look at the direction that we're going in terms of the, you know, I'm more of a fiscal conservative, somewhat socially liberal, but I just this really bothers me. I don't want our foreign policy being driven by this kind of biblical prophetic direction.
View, we've got it, Mark, and thanks very much for your call. Jen Reed, take us for a moment into the other side of this equation, the money side, and in particular Tom DeLay's very interesting relationship with the lobbyist community. He, as you guys describe it, and others, hasn't been satisfied just to have a relation with K Street, the sort of canyon in Washington where so many lobbyists are ensconced. You describe him reaching out to actually not just hear the lobbyists, but to control in some way the world of lobbying itself. What's going on there?
Well, it kind of comes back to where he got the nickname the Hammer in the Contract with America Congress when he was going to dismantle the EPA and all government regulation that he could. he brought lobbyists in and set them up and proceeded to write bills for days on end.
The lobbyists writing the bills.
Lobbyists, and that's not complete. Anyone who's followed the Congress or state legislatures know that lobbyists will certainly volunteer to do that. But mm-hmm. this was completely unprecedented the way that he did that. And but in return for the privilege of doing that. They were keeping books on, now what are you going to do for us? And how that is measured is in dollars. And as they gained a strength in their majority, then he took it farther in that was laying out the law that you can only, as Lou was saying earlier, you can only hire Republicans, and that your job is to advance a Republican agenda. And if you don't, then you're not going to serve your clients. You're not going to have a place at the table. And it's been he's been very successful at placing a former aide, particularly in positions of great power on K Street. And one of his big political problems is that's unfolding now is the excesses of that to lobbyists who are involved in a huge unfolding scandal dozens of millions of dollars bilked from American Indian tribes around the country, and they were dismissed by their firm. Washington Post has been all over it.
Tens of millions of dollars there, and those guys are in trouble. May come back to Tom DeLay. We don't know. Phil's calling from Westwood, Massachusetts. Hi, Phil. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Just great. Thanks.
I'd try to do this as quickly as possible. I was solicited by one of Tom DeLay's organizations for solicited for a contribution, but it started by being awarded a small business leadership award, and one of his organizations involved this anti-regulation lobbying, and I was installed as the chairman of the Massachusetts chapter of this organization. There was, of course, the desire for me to contribute, which I never did, but I was installed as the chairman of the organization. I was sent the filigree, the signed picture from George Bush and the filigree award and so forth.
This all sounds like politics as usual to me, Phil.
Yeah, but here's the point, and there are two points I want to make quickly. Number one, what was very reassuring to me about the whole experience, because I played along with it, was they had absolutely no idea who I was or what my political persuasion was.
Okay,
whatsoever.
And two, yep.
And had I gone into this organization, I would have made a mess of things as long as they would have allowed me to. But number two, in the initial contact, I was on another telephone call when the first call came in, and I was only able to get the call from a voter caller ID. And when I called back the caller ID, it was an insurance company in Ohio.
That was calling you on behalf?
That was calling me on behalf of this organization.
Phil, we're going to let you go there because our time is so short. We get the flavor of that. I want to ask, I should say, we called Tom DeLay's office. We asked for some representative to come on and give his side of the story tonight. They did not respond to that request. But Lou DeBose, where is this going? Do you see already there's been the notion that Tom DeLay was the effective Speaker of the House, Dennis Hastert kind of his guy. Is that dream behind him, or does he still have a sun coming up for Tom DeLay?
Stick a fork in it. It's over. He will not be Speaker of the House. Journalists are cautioned not to write about the future, but I think in this case we're safe. I want to take a minute to mention what I'm doing here in Louisiana.
And that's all we've got, so make it snappy.
Story. $66 million billed by two former delay aides, one former delay aide and one lobbyist, $66 million, $31 million from one Indian tribe here of 800 people. And John McCain is now looking into that, and the federal jury, grand jury is looking into it. It was taken from the health education funds of these Indians, and some of it was kicked back to Tom DeLay's PACs. So this is a scandal that seems to have no end, Tom.
Well, we have not heard the last of it. It is a story that goes on. Hopefully we'll get Tom DeLay's view one of these evenings. But tonight, Lou DeBose and Jan Reed, thanks so much for coming on. Great to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The book is The Hammer, Tom DeLay, God, Money, and the Rise of the Republican Congress. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, John Kerry and George Bush gear up for tomorrow night's debate. This is On Point. With nearly every national poll showing the two presidential candidates now in a dead heat, George W. Bush and John Kerry spent much of the day today prepping for tomorrow night's final debate. The 90-minute tussle in Tempe will likely be the last time that the candidates have the national television attention of tens of millions of Americans before the vote. President Bush spoke today at campaign rallies in Colorado Springs and Paradise Valley, Arizona. Senator Kerry spent the day preparing in seclusion. Kerry did speak on the stump in Santa Fe, New Mexico, yesterday. Both candidates have been focusing the past few days on domestic issues, the topic of tomorrow night's debate.
On issue after issue, my opponent has showed why he earned his ranking as the most liberal member of the United States Senate.
George Bush is trying to scare you, trying to scare all Americans into thinking that I'm going to raise your taxes, when he knows that I have a plan that lowers the middle class taxes for 98% of all Americans. I lower the cost of doing business and I lower corporate tax rates for 99% of all businesses.
He would not raise taxes for anyone who earns less than $200,000 a year. The problem is, to keep that promise, he would have to break almost all of his other ones.
In the last 4 years, the cost of heating the average home has gone up 91%, and high energy costs have pushed up prices across the board, from the food that you have on your table to the clothes that you and your children wear.
He tried to tell Americans that when it comes to his health care plan, and I quote, "The government has nothing to do with it." Facts are, 8 out of 10 people who get health care under Senator Kerry's plan will be placed on a government program.
Just like on every other policy facing our country, they'll tell you that they have an energy plan. Remember that song, The Great Pretender? Maybe some of you aren't old enough. Oh, yes, you're the great pretender. But as usual, if you look at the plans, they're plans that warm the hearts of their powerful friends, and they leave you, they leave the American people out in the cold.
You're not going to have fiscal sanity. But John Kerry is the president. He's been the most liberal member of the United States Senate, which means he likes to spend your money. That's what that means.
George W. Bush speaking in Colorado Springs and Paradise Valley, Arizona, and John Kerry stumping in Santa Fe, New Mexico. The two candidates square off for their third and final debate tomorrow night in Tempe, Arizona. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Jane Manners, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman. With help from Tim Skog and Lauren Madelon, our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.